I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, teenagers are getting ready for the summer, but for many of them, it is not all sun and fun. There have been gloomy numbers on the jobs front. So we're going to speak with Hilda Solis. She is the Secretary of Labor, and she'll tell us about how the administration is trying to help more teens get that coveted summer job. But first, we go to the other end of the education spectrum, where you think those job concerns might not be a big issue. Now, we've talked on this program a number of times about how more Americans have been relying on food stamps and unemployment benefits to get by. But you might be surprised to learn, as we were, frankly, about one group that has taken a particularly hard hit. The number of people with PhDs who have had to apply for food stamps or other government assistance like unemployment more than tripled between 2007 and 2010, according to a recent study. The Chronicle of Higher Education recently reported on this, and we wanted to know more, so we've called upon staff reporter Stacy Patton. Also with us is Tony Yang. He received his PhD from the University of California, Riverside, 3 years ago. He's worked off and on as a history lecturer since then, but he has also relied on unemployment benefits and food stamps to get by. I welcome you both. Thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Michelle.
Thank you.
Stacy Patton, let me start with you. Why are people with doctorates getting hit so hard?
Well, I guess there's a bit of backstory to answer your question. When I started covering graduate students for the Chronicle, I noticed that there's a lot of overlap between graduate students and adjuncts. These are contingent faculty who are working on contracts. And there's been a major shift in the past 30 years in universities' reliance on contingent faculty. They work part-time, they don't have health benefits, they can be fired or not have their contracts renewed. And so it's a much cheaper way. It's a cost-cutting measure for many universities. But what we continue to do in graduate schools is to encourage people to get master's degrees and PhDs. And the economy has taken such a hit, and so has higher ed has taken such a hit, that they do their work and then come out and not have, you know, opportunities for jobs.
Well, let's bring Professor Yang in here, because he's kind of a real-world example of exactly what you're talking about. Professor Yang, you graduated in 2009, and you told Stacy that the first thing you did was file for unemployment. And then for the past 3 years, you have worked, but as I understand it, you've never been able to put enough hours together to earn a living wage. Does that about sum it up?
That about sums it up. I think one of the bravest things to do is to try to graduate into the Great Recession. But it's an extremely difficult job market, and you're always constantly hustling to try to get another job or an appointment, and you don't turn them down even though you probably should. And it's an experience I think a lot of us have shared, those of us who are just coming out onto the job market right now, particularly in higher education.
At your peak, your best year of earnings, do you mind if I ask, what was it?
It was about $32,000.
$32,000 in your best year. Yeah. What about your worst?
Ten. Yeah.
So you were making as much as a nanny, basically.
Probably.
A full-time nanny in an urban area who's actually making what they're supposed to make, you know. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, Professor V.P. Franklin, he teaches here, and he was teaching at Harvard on one of these renewable contracts years ago. And someone at Harvard, one of the tenured faculty members, told him, well, but you have prestige at teaching at Harvard. His response was, and this is my response to my students, I can't eat prestige. Mm. You know, I have the prestige of holding a PhD, but that ain't paying the bills.
We're talking about the rising number of people with advanced degrees who are relying on food stamps and other government assistance to get by. I'm speaking with Tony Yang. He holds a doctorate and has used government benefits to make ends meet. He's currently unemployed. Stacy Patton is a reporter for the Chronicle of Higher Education, and she wrote about this recently. Stacy Patton, you talked about the fact that a number of states have cut their higher education budgets. Are the universities who are using what you call contingent faculty, what I think a lot of people call adjuncts, explicitly as a cost-saving measure, or is there some other cover story, if I can use that phrase?
It depends on who you ask. Certainly, many of the adjuncts would say that it is definitely cost-cutting measure. And so the universities will say, well, our budgets are being cut. We would love to hire more full-time faculty, but we just can't.
Did you have a hard time getting people to talk about this? And I guess the other question I was asking is, did people feel a sense of shame about this?
Mm-hmm. Well, I would hear graduate students and adjuncts say, well, I make so little bit of money that I actually qualify for food stamps. And so what I did was I got in touch with many organizations such as the New Faculty Majority, Coalition of Academic Workers, and other unions, and talked with their leaders and said, hey, have you heard of people who are actually on government assistance? And they all said yes. The people just kept emailing me, telling me their stories. And then it was a matter of, well, who wants to go on record? And definitely there was a lot of shame. There were a lot of people who wanted to remain anonymous, because you go to graduate school, you get a master's degree, you get a PhD. It's a hard thing to embrace that you're also now on welfare.
Mm-hmm. Professor Yang, do you mind if I ask you, was it a difficult decision for you to decide to go public about your circumstances and to be interviewed and to use your name?
You know, I don't have a problem with that. It might just be my personality. It might have been really the fact that I grew up on food stamps and grew up poor. And I really don't have a problem with it. And I'm not particularly judgmental about it. My parents, on the other hand, are probably a little bit ashamed. I've had my mom tell me on more than one occasion I got the wrong PhD, because mine's in history and not in computer science. And because I could somehow be gainfully employed. There's this perception out there that if you have a PhD, you remarkably walk into a $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 a year job. And that's just simply not the case.
Well, let me just focus on something you just talked about here, which is your choice of area of study, your particular academic discipline. There were some comments I noted on Stacey, on the site about this. There were a number of people who offered their own stories, but there were also a lot of people who were very unsympathetic, Professor Yang. They kind of took the same position as your mom, which is, you're smart. Why couldn't you figure out that this was going to be a soft job market? And I apologize if that sounds hurtful, but I did want to ask if that factored into your decision-making at all.
To some extent, it did. I mean, that's why I'm doing economic history and not just, you know, a cultural study of the New Left, not to deride those sort of studies, but it did guide it at some level for that. On the other hand, I think that there's a specific problem with justifying the lack of available full-time teaching positions by sort of saying, well, you know, the market dictates what the market dictates. In a larger political sort of aspect, we teach civics and how the government functions. And when you slash budgets, particularly on the humanities side, you're saying that it's not as important as the engineering disciplines or as in the biochemistry disciplines. And that has very deep effects. And something I tell my students, that the result of some of this horrible political divisiveness or people not understanding political ideology or rhetoric can be directly traced to the lack of underfunding, you know, these basic civics classes.
Stacey Patton, have you found that there are certain disciplines where graduates or people who hold these degrees are more likely to be underemployed than others? Does it tend to be concentrated in the humanities?
From what I'm hearing, yes. I did a short survey that accompanied the piece and took note of the top fields in which graduate degree holders were also food stamp recipients. And they, I believe the top were English and history and communications or something like that. But there were people who were also in biology and in the sciences. I saw maybe two respondents who were in the math.
And finally, you mentioned that there's a vast gap between people who have kind of tenured positions, administrators, and people like Professor Yang who are just starting their careers. Is this seen as a problem in the academy?
Oh, I definitely. I hear all the time from adjunct advocacy groups. I hear it from the adjuncts themselves. I think graduate students are also very anxious. The level of transparency about student outcomes and the availability of jobs and what we're training students to actually do to meet the market demands is starting to be a serious conversation. In terms of people with master's and PhDs on government assistance, I think has come as a shock to many people. I too was shocked by the numbers. It's about 1% of master's degree holders and 1% of PhD degree holders who were on government assistance. So someone might come along and say, oh, that's such a small number. But what's frightening to me is that the numbers more than doubled in a 3-year period. And so one has to wonder, is this trend going to continue to increase if the government's data has actually captured a full picture of people who have these degrees, who are also in graduate school, and also relying on food stamps or are even eligible for government assistance.
Professor Yang, I have to ask, if you had to do it all over again, do you think you would still pursue your doctorate in this area, in your discipline?
I would. I think we're always worth pursuing intellectual pursuits. It's always worth it to sort of gain a better understanding of the world. And let's face it, you know, if you have a PhD, you're in a subset of the population that has a tremendous amount of skill and determination to actually get that degree. I think at the end of the day, your skills will translate to something. It just might not be in our field. And that's something that's a little bit sad because we're losing a lot of potential and a lot of expertise. But I think it certainly is worth it, at least from an intellectual standpoint, to go ahead and pursue your interest and curiosity and find out what, you know, your subject matter is all about.
Tony Yang has a PhD in history from the University of California, Riverside, and he was kind enough to join us from that campus. Stacey Patton is a staff reporter at the Chronicle of Higher Education, and she wrote about the number of people with advanced degrees and graduate students who are relying on government benefits, including food stamps, to make ends meet, and she joined us from Baltimore. Thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Thanks, Michelle.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, maybe you've been hearing about this big Facebook stock offering later this week, and you said to yourself, I need to call my broker. And then you realized, wait, I don't have a broker. This is why we are going to talk with one of our money coaches in a few minutes about the basics of investing. Investing 101 with Luis Barajas is up next. But first, a different conversation about the economy. We want to talk about summer jobs. With the school year coming to a close, many young people have already started the search for a summer job, and in recent years that has been a tough thing to find, especially for teens. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the unemployment rate currently stands at 8.1%, but for teenagers, that means between people aged 16 and 19 years old, the unemployment rate is more than triple the national average, clocking in at 24.9%. The Obama administration is hoping a new initiative will help some young people find those critical summer jobs. They're calling the program Summer Jobs Plus. And here with us now, the Secretary of Labor, Hilda Solis, is going to tell us more. Madam Secretary, thanks so much for joining us once again. Welcome back to the program.
Yes, thank you for having me. And I'm really excited about this initiative because what you said is very, very true. Many of our young people between the ages of 16 and 24 are actually experiencing record high unemployment. And so what that means is that 21 out of 100 low-income teens are out there that actually had a job. 21 out of 100, that's very low, and we need to improve that. And since we haven't received any new funding from the Congress, we've decided that we're not going to wait, that we're going to actually ask entrepreneurs, business people, nonprofit organizations to help us come up with slots so that young people can have that initial work experience.
And what are you going to do differently now that you have this initiative that you didn't do last summer or that you wouldn't be doing otherwise?
Well,
is there anything, or are you just jawboning?
No. It's actually creating a large Summer Jobs Plus bank. So what we're doing is collecting information by way of those businesses that want to list those jobs with us in a centralized area, including internships and other opportunities, mentorships. Most importantly, though, I think is that we're really creating an incentive for new partners to come into this. So while last year we did this on a volunteer basis, again, we had about 80,000 jobs. Now we're close to 100,000 that would be paid, and our goal is 300,000 jobs.
But what's the incentive for a business owner? I mean, are you offering a tax credit? What are you offering to a business owner to hire someone? Because presumably, if business owners need people to work and have the capacity to pay them, wouldn't they be offering the job anyway? So what's the incentive for a business owner?
A lot of it is also highlighting their particular business because they get, how could I say, the light shown on them that they're doing the right thing in their community. And not only that, but many of these young people who live in their communities where these businesses are tend to turn out to be good employees and sometimes are offered positions to come back or they stay the remainder of the year. And I've heard many stories from people who told me they started out as a potential summer job employee and ended up coming back almost every year during their time in college as they went on and furthered their education. So you build loyalty.
So you're hoping that it for the company, the incentive is it's in part kind of a positive brand identity or something
and
of,
you know
of that
what
sort,
it
positive
is.
Advertising.
It is, because I've been to different cities now with different mayors, for example, the city of Los Angeles, where I talked to a group of Chamber of Commerce members. Not all of them were on board previously in terms of summer jobs, but after we made the presentation and heard testimony from some of the businesses that hired these folks up, and then we heard from the participants or graduates of some of these programs, people were convinced that they wanted to be a part of it.
If you're just joining us, this is Tell Me More. I'm speaking with the Secretary of Labor, Hilda Solis. We're talking about an initiative to help young people find summer jobs. It's called Summer Jobs Plus. I see you talked about the website a couple of times, and I see that there's an effort to make it kind of fun, build some excitement around it. Mm-hmm. And to that end, you've called upon some celebrities to talk about their first summer job experience. I just want to play one that caught our eye from the late night host, Jimmy Fallon. Here it is.
My first job was cleaning gum and stuff from the electronic mats that were in front of the grocery stores. You know, you'd step on the mats and doors would open, and I had like a wooden stick and I'd scrape it out. I remember my mom, my grandmother came by one day as I was doing it, and my grandmother started crying. But the skill that I learned is don't be embarrassed to work hard, even if what you do makes your grandma cry. Because I do work today that still makes her cry. I mean, look at me in this outfit. I'm sorry, Grandma.
I could totally relate to that.
Yeah. Tell us your summer job. Hopefully you didn't make your grandma cry in your first summer job. What was yours?
Actually, I was a recreation aide in the summer at one of the local elementary schools that had their recreation program ongoing. And so I got to help feed low-income families there with summer lunch. But also, I got to take kids from the inner city that had never gone to different recreational locations like the beach, the mountains, you know, and do fun activities, which, you know, young people need as well. So it was kind of like a mentor, and it was neat because I felt empowered, I felt respected, and I also had to carry out a responsibility because I had a supervisor there who was telling me, don't do this, do that. And so I learned a lot, and when I got my paycheck, even though it wasn't maybe right now by our standards a lot. At that time, it meant a lot. It meant I could buy a pair of clothing, shoes, I could open a checking account. And those are things that help to provide value to young people.
Okay, so what's the first thing you bought with your first paycheck? You can tell me.
I think I probably bought some shoes. Girls are always into shoes.
On a serious note, though, Madam Secretary, the Department of Labor has identified minority youth as having a particularly tough time finding jobs.
Yes.
According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, only 34.6% of African-American youth and 42.9% of Hispanic youth had a job this past July. Why do you think that is?
I think a lot of it has to do with where they are found in terms of the conditions. If there's high unemployment and you're not seeing a lot of job growth immediately, of course, that's going to have a dramatic impact on them. And also education in terms of what skills they have available. That's why it's important to give them their first jobs, especially for African-American and Latino young people. It's very, very important. That's what's going to make or break many of them in the future. And I can recall so many people that I've met. I mean, I've even heard Valerie Jarrett talk about her first summer job, Cecilia Munoz. These are top-ranking individuals in the White House. And people need to go online and listen to their stories because, you know what, we all start from somewhere. Well, and if someone doesn't give us that first shot, shame on them. But if businesses want to come up to speed and do the patriotic thing, then help list those jobs. Let's help these young people no matter where they live.
And finally, Madam Secretary, the administration is also jawboning businesses around the issue of veterans employment and yes. military families employment. And I just wondered if you are at all concerned that you're jawboning too many things. I mean, it just that in some ways maybe the priorities are competing with each other.
They're not.
One of the things, no. Well, let me just finish my question. One of the things we're hearing from young people is that the jobs that young people would otherwise get are being filled by adults. And I'm just wondering whether you feel that in some ways these priorities are competing against each other.
Not necessarily, no. Because we still have many, many employers that want to hire young people. And I think what we need to do is make the better match. We need to make sure that we have the right type of students and, you know, what they're looking for, and then making it available online so they know where the communities are, where these jobs are listed. And I don't believe that. I believe that there are opportunities for many people. There are many businesses, obviously, that have initiatives that are especially targeted to veterans and their spouses, which we also undertake, because I have a whole division dedicated to employment of veterans. So I don't see that as taking up more space. I think that many cities, especially city mayors, like big city mayors and others, have been doing this for many years, and they're going to continue to do this to create space so young people can have that firsthand experience, because it reduces crime, it gives them a shot at the American pie, because they learn how to work in a work environment, they learn responsibility that they may not get otherwise just staying at home or getting in trouble.
Hilda Solis is the Secretary of Labor, and she was kind enough to join us from her office in Washington, D.C. Madam Secretary, thanks so much for speaking with us once again.
Thanks so much.
And now we turn from getting a start in the job market to getting started investing. And call us crazy, but we are guessing that even if you never read the business pages or watch those cable shows where people are talking really fast over a stock ticker, then you still might have heard that the social networking site Facebook is offering stock for sale to the public for the first time on Friday. It's called an initial public offering, and shares would cost at least $34 a piece. Now, the social networking site has more than 900 million active users, and we figured people might be thinking now's a good opportunity to invest for the first time. And while investing can lead to big payoffs, it can also mean taking big risks. Just look at the chief investment officer of JP Morgan Chase, who recently resigned after the bank suffered a $2 billion loss. So you might be thinking, if that can happen to top professional investors, what's a newbie to do? Well, who better to go to for some basic information than personal finance expert Luis Barajas? He's the author of a number of books. Welcome back. Thanks so much for joining us once again.
Michelle, always a pleasure.
So first of all, why so much excitement about this Facebook IPO? Do you think it's because so many people use it that they figure that they understand it?
They're engaged in it every single day. They're looking at their Facebook page and they're saying, wow, I can be part of this. I can be an owner of this. And so there's a lot of interest. Unfortunately, the problem for most people, it's going to be not the best thing for them to do, but it's at least getting them interested in figuring out what a stock is and how I can buy stock, and maybe I can start investing in the near future.
Well, yeah, talk more about that. You're saying that for most people, it probably isn't the best initial investment, at least. I mean, people often say that if you're going to buy stock, you should buy in something that you use, believe in, or like. So why wouldn't this be a good choice?
Here's the thing. I deal with usually what I call the overlooked and underserved markets, people that normally do not invest in the stock market or invest at all. And if they go out and buy one individual stock and their money goes down and they don't know how this investment works, then they get this negative taste in their mouth, and they're most of the time, they don't want to go back into the market. And so usually we need to take a step back and take a look at what we're doing and why do we want to buy a stock?
Okay, well, let's do that. What are the first questions you should ask yourself if you're thinking about getting started investing?
Okay, well, first of all, what you need to do is you got to sit down and take a look at your investment objectives, your goals. What are you trying to do? And don't tell me you're trying to make more money. We're all trying to make more money. But is it a short-term goal, a long-term goal? Are you trying to build your emergency reserves? Are you trying to pay down credit card debt? Are you trying to invest for your future in the down payment of a home? You know, the next thing is the time horizon. How much time do you need? If you're going to have a very short time horizon, the last thing you need to be in, Michelle, are in stocks. You have to give yourself at least a 7-year time frame in case your stock goes down. You're willing to wait for it to go back up. So you need to be patient. Those are the most important things.
So a 7-year time frame, if you need that money sometime within 7 years, you're saying stocks, or at least putting all your investment money into stocks, not a good choice for you. What about what investors call risk tolerance? You know, what is that? And how do you figure out what your risk tolerance is?
Basically, bottom line, it's volatility. Here's what I mean. You invest $1,000 in stock, and the very next day you see it go down to $500. Can you sleep at night? Is your whole day spent on looking on the internet, seeing what your stock price is worth? That's what we're talking about, risk tolerance. How much volatility are you willing to stomach? Is it 10% negative downturn? Is it a 20% downturn? And the problem is that a lot of young investors really haven't gone through any of that. And they say, I can really handle a lot of risk, until you see that their stock's gone down 20 or 30%, and then they're hating life and they're calling you every day and they want out.
And you don't want that. You're happy to talk to them, but you don't want to be talking to them every day.
Not really, no.
If you're just joining us, we are just days away from the Facebook initial public offering. So we're talking about investing for newbies with personal finance expert Luis Barajas. He's the author of a number of books, and he's also a certified financial planner. And he actually prefers to work with people who don't have a lot of experience. That's who he's most concerned about. So is there a minimum amount of money that you should have before you start thinking about investing in stocks, which, as I think you probably want to remind people, means that you kind of have an ownership share in a company? I mean, is there any rule of thumb that you use?
What I want to do is I want to make sure they have a comfortable emergency reserve. Even if they've got $1,000, I want to see them put some money aside. I'm also going to take a look at their credit card debt and their school loans. If they've got credit card debt that they're paying at 19, 20%, and then they're out there investing money where they're not sure what it's going to do, but they're not paying down their credit card debt, I don't want to do that. I want to work on that debt first. And then, you know, they can start with as little as $50 a month investing, and they can go to wonderful websites out there and Google a lot of these wonderful places that you can start investing for very inexpensively, because it's one other thing that we've got to talk about, Michelle, are costs. You really want to focus on expenses and what they're charging you to invest. Those things will make a big difference over the long term.
If you want to start investing, who should you go to? And is there somebody you should avoid?
You want to avoid anybody who is charging you a commission, who's trying to sell you anything, and that's the only way they earn their money. I really don't like that conflict of interest. And so I really like to work with what I call fee-only certified financial planners. But, you know, the audience needs to understand that the only people in America that can really give you investment advice are registered investment advisors. And a registered investment advisor, that's not a designation, nor is it an approval by a federal agency like the Securities and Exchange Commission or the state that they're in. People who are going to give you investment advice and are going to charge you for the investment advice must register with one of those agencies. And that way, they are a fiduciary for you, that they're putting your best interest first, and that what they do for you is also suitable, that they're really taking the time and taking a look at, is this the best investment for you? Mm-hmm. And so you want to always talk about the three C's. You want to look at their credentials. Also, you want to double check their character. And again, what we just talked about is, you know, their compensation. How are they charging you?
Okay, so the three C's. Keep that in mind. So I know a lot of people will have been reading about this big loss at J.P. Morgan Chase, and they might be thinking, gee, if somebody who invests all day for a living can make a big mistake like that, what hope do I have?
But the problem is that for the average investor, they have to take a look at what's happening. And what gets most people, whether you're highly intelligent investor or non, what gets in the way is behavioral, what I call behavioral finance, or greed or fear. The mistakes that they were making were based on greed. And anytime you make decisions based on greed or fear, whether it's your own personal investing, you're always going to end up losing. And that's why it's really important to get a lot of information before you invest. You also know that you're well diversified. And the last couple of things we want to talk about is, you never invest in anything you don't understand, and you never borrow money to invest.
All right. Luis Barajas is a certified financial planner. He's the author of a number of books, including his latest, Small Business, Big Life for Women. And he was kind enough to join us from Costa Mesa, California. Luis, thanks so much for joining us once again.
Always a pleasure. Thank you so much, Michelle.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. They say it takes a village to raise a child, but maybe you just need a few moms in your corner. Every week, we check in with a diverse group of parents for their common sense and savvy parenting advice. Today, we wanted to turn our attention to international adoption, specifically from the East African country of Ethiopia, which might ring a bell because that's where actress Angelina Jolie adopted her daughter Zahara in 2005. And it might surprise you to learn, as we did from a recent report in the Wall Street Journal, that since 1999, more than 11,000 adoptions in the U.S. have come from Ethiopia. And although the figures dropped last year due to tougher laws set by the Ethiopian government, over the past 2 years, Ethiopia has been second only to China as a destination for Americans seeking to adopt. That's because the country's short waiting periods and the availability of infants and toddlers has made it attractive after scandals in other countries like Guatemala caused agencies to look elsewhere. But there have also been complaints that the process is more susceptible to abuse than it should be. We wanted to talk more about this, so we've called upon three mothers who have all adopted from Ethiopia and have had varying experiences. Bridgette Davis adopted Ababitu in 2008. She joined a family that already included one biological son. Dr. Jane Aronson is a pediatrician. She's also CEO and founder of Worldwide Orphans Foundation. She has two boys, and her 14-year-old was adopted from Ethiopia in 2004. Also with us, Cindy Burt, who adopted Mihiret in 2008. She also has two biological sons and a daughter, Beatrice, who was later adopted from Uganda. And I want to mention that Cindy Burt is coming to us via her mobile phone from Germany. So if you hear birds in the background and some noises on the line, that's what you're hearing. With that being said, welcome, ladies, moms, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
And let me just start by saying, you know, there's a lot of value judgment around adoption, especially international adoption. So I'm going to declare this a no judgment zone so that people can speak freely about whatever they want to say. And I'll start with you, Bridgette. Why did you decide to adopt from Ethiopia? And was it a good experience?
I realized when my son, my biological son, was about 6 or 7 that I actually did want another child. I was very clear I wanted a daughter. I didn't feel any need to try to give birth to another child. I thought adoption would be a great option. And I had heard about a few people through word of mouth who'd had good experiences adopting from Ethiopia. And then the clincher for me was that it was an African country, and that felt right. I'm African American. And I had a feel about that part. I wanted to, if I could, adopt from this African country and sort of help myself and perhaps help that child at the same time.
And it was okay? It was a good experience? You felt
it was beyond okay.
Mm-hmm.
It was beyond okay. It's been amazing. And when I say amazing, I don't mean perfect. I just mean incredible. I've grown. She's taught me so much. She's changed our family for the better. She's a joy. And I can't imagine not having done it.
Cindy Burt, what about you? And I should mention that you are speaking to us from Germany, and you are outside in search of a good Wi-Fi hotspot. So I just want to explain why people
yes.
might be hearing birds chirping behind you. Your experience was a little different. Would you tell us about that?
Yeah, we felt no need to continue having children biologically. And Ethiopia, everything about it was a great fit. We've had some tough things come up, but the actual experience of adopting her was beautiful.
So, Cindy, as I understand it, though, the difficulty is that you thought that your daughter was an orphan. It turns out she's not.
We were told that her father had passed away, and that was not true. And there were several other things that we found out were not true. Ours is a pretty mild fraud compared to some that I've heard. So we are grateful for that.
Does she know? Does your daughter know that her biological parents are still alive?
Yes, she does.
So, Dr. Aronson, you have deep experience in this field. I mean, you are, as I mentioned, you're a pediatrician. You are also the founder of a foundation. You've seen many adoptive children over the years. And you are also an adoptive parent from Ethiopia, also previously adopted from Vietnam. I'm just wondering, which experience do you think is more common, Cindy's or Bridgette's?
I think there are a lot more different kinds of experiences than Bridgette's and Cindy's, actually. I'm a person who deals in the gray. I've seen well over 10,000 children adopted from abroad, and I've been doing adoption medicine for 25 years. But I think what I want to focus in on right here is that the use of the word fraud is very challenging for me. Adoption comes to us through many cultural dysfunction, if you will. The definition of an orphan is a little quirky. Mm-hmm. You know, UNICEF defines it as a child less than 18 who's lost either one or both parents. That's quirky in a way because lots of people grow up with one parent and they don't see themselves as an orphan. But the truth of the matter is, you know, there's lots of children in the world. The vast majority of orphans, by the way, are social orphans where the family is there. Both parents are alive, but they have no means of supervision. The family may be ill, unable to live in a home setting of permanency because of extreme poverty. So then the child is thought to be best placed in an orphanage or in an adoptive home, whether domestically or internationally. Mm. Yeah. So this plays a big role, in my opinion, for what Cindy is talking about. And I hope that we can somehow, you know, understand that that still can be an orphan child. And in Ethiopia, just so, because that's what we're talking about today, I really, in my years of doing adoption medicine, and I'm not part of the process in the country necessarily, but I really haven't seen fraud. I have many stories in my back pocket about an uncle or an aunt coming to an orphanage and relinquishing a young baby, a toddler, an older child, more than one child, sibling groups. Mm-hmm. And then I see them saying, you know, I'm Uncle Getachu and I'm Aunt Betelem. But they may actually be the parents.
Well, Dr. Aronson, I just want to stop you right there and ask, Cindy Burt, what is it that most concerns you? Is it that you feel that they were misled or you feel that that they didn't really understand that they were relinquishing her forever, that they thought she was going to come back, like going to school and then come back in the summers or something like that? What's the thing that concerns you most?
The thing that concerns me most about our experience was, as we saw, her lack of trust over time. She would get almost there, 95% of the way, and then she would sort of stop.
I see. So she felt like she started out her life being lied to, and
right.
Yeah, and that's kind of fun. Well, what have you done since? I know you sought out the parents. Have you been able to reconnect with both just to help her put that missing piece of the puzzle together?
At this point, we send letters, photos, and video, and we get some in return. I think she really struggled with that reconnection in the beginning. I think we almost destabilized her place in our family by suddenly reintroducing another family to her. So we've just worked through it slowly but surely, and we do hope to go visit them soon. So we're looking forward to it.
Brigitte, let me ask, did you feel or ever experience a sense of judgment around your decision to adopt from Ethiopia? You obviously kept your daughter's Ethiopian name. I assume that was the name she was given at birth.
Yes.
Tell me about that.
My experience might be particular, again, to my being African American. I think a lot of my Black friends didn't understand. They might not have come out and said, why are you doing this? But they had their way of making it clear to me they didn't get it. Mm. Because there are, as some did say to me, many, millions of Black children in this country who need parents. Why would you go all the way over there like them? That's
like
the
them?
Implication.
What's the like them? I don't understand.
Like
who's
them,
them
is wealthier white families who some people in the Black community judge for making that choice. They feel it's perhaps there's something that's faddish about it. And so there was a confusion, I think, and curiosity and real concern that I was somehow neglecting my own, quote unquote, to make this choice.
Did anybody say that to you or you just picked up that vibe?
I've had at least one person just come out and say, this is my concern. Huh. But I knew that was the implicit point that these people were making to me. And I understood it. I didn't like it, but I understood it. I thought it was narrow-minded. But I knew it came from a lack of understanding, too. And I'm happy to say that more African Americans are adopting from Ethiopia and from other countries. They are, you know, it's just, it was a foreign experience, literally,
to
a lot of people.
Sure. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. In the past 2 years, nearly one out of five children adopted by Americans internationally came from Ethiopia. And our moms today all adopted from that country, and they're sharing their experiences with us. I'm joined today by Dr. Jane Aronson. She is a pediatrician. She's also the CEO and founder of Worldwide Orphans Foundation. Cindy Burt is with us, and Brigitte Davis. Oh, Dr. Aronson, I didn't ask about your experience. I know. What about you?
I had an experience a lot like Bridget's. I adopted a 6-year-old boy. We already had a 4-year-old at home who was adopted as an infant from Vietnam. And I was really eager to adopt an older child because I felt that that would be a nice experience for us as a family, especially for my son. And I felt very strongly about the fact that older children rarely get an opportunity to have permanency out of a situation like that. And yet, I would say that when a child first comes home, there are a lot of challenges. The child has to learn English and has to learn what it's like to live in a permanent family and has to trust. And it takes a long time. I mean, my son will be 14 in July, and I still see that he's forever, you know, changing and evolving in his understanding of himself as a person who lost his family, as a person who was adopted, and as a person who's an Ethiopian boy, now a teen, in a family with two moms and an Asian brother. It's all, you know, complicated stuff that he has to figure out, and he does a darn good job, and he has a great sense of humor, by the way, about it all.
Well, I'm gonna take your word of wisdom on this, Dr. Aronson, and not try to generalize from the three experiences here and make them sort of universal about adoption or about adoption from Ethiopia in particular. So, well, just to conclude, I'll just ask each of you for your word of wisdom for other parents who may be contemplating adoption, particularly from Ethiopia, for whatever reason. So, Dr. Aronson, do you want to start? What's your word of wisdom?
I think you really have to not be judgmental. I mean, it's about everything in life, I think. I'm giving myself my own advice right now. So as a parent, you need not to be judgmental. You have to have an open heart. But at the same time, you have to really be prepared for the kinds of things that you are not thinking about. And then I think Cindy laid out a story which is important for us to hear because it shows us that there may be quirks and things that are different about the unfolding of the child's story. And I think that those things, and I know in all my 25 years of doing this, this is not just about Ethiopia. It's about that world. Hmm. It's a complicated world, and there are lots of things that you may not know that you may find out later in life. And so I try to tell people, don't be so definitive. You represent the story in the best way you can, but you try to be open, and you try to be able to take in what may change. And also, especially for older children, about their memory. I want to say finally that children may not be able to express what they know initially because they're afraid, they don't have the language. And then over time, let me tell you that things come out. And even now, my son will be 14, we still have some unraveling of very interesting perceptions and thoughts and feelings about what happened to him and pieces of memory that are so difficult for him to know. Is this really things you told me? Are these things I might imagine? Are these things real? That's the most fascinating part. And to not jump to the place where you then say, can't be.
Mm-mm. I see. Interesting. Cindy, what's your word of wisdom?
Ooh, I know for a fact that there are a lot of children in Ethiopia that are in need of homes right now. I really, truly believe that international adoption is a great thing. Our second adoption was fantastic and really showed us all the good things that it can be. Maybe that's another thing I would say is it's tough to know that we were part of something that caused our daughter pain because we sure love her and we're sorry that happened.
Bridget, what's your word of wisdom?
Well, I would say that it's important to keep in mind that there are no guarantees when you give birth. I've done both. I've had a birth child and an adoptive child. They're both a crapshoot. One is no more guaranteed than the other, and you have to go into either experience with that understanding that you have to just know you have signed on and you will accept whatever happens because you decided this. You made the decision, not the child. The child didn't ask to come here. So I feel you have that responsibility. I would also say to an adoptive parent, please, please do not assume that your child should feel grateful. I think that has caused so many problems in adoptive households because the parents had fantasies and expectations and believed that they had gone through so much to, quote unquote, help this child, that the child doesn't feel grateful enough. Unfortunately, it's a human reaction, but I just want to say, not with judgment, but with warning, that, you know, we have to constantly remember this child has been snatched, literally, from all they know. Into a brand new world. And so if we have that patience and we put all the pressure and expectation and responsibility on ourselves and not on the child, that hopefully it can turn out well.
Our moms today, all adopted from Ethiopia. Bridgette Davis and Dr. Jane Aronson joined us from our studios in New York. Cindy Burt joined us from her home in Germany. Ladies, moms, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
You're welcome. You're welcome.
Thank you for having us.
And next week in our Moms panel, we'll continue our conversation about women and weight that we started on Monday. You might remember that we talked about that op-ed by writer Alice Randall in the New York Times that's causing a bit of a stir. She said, quote, many black women are fat because we want to be, unquote. Now, many people took to the blogosphere to blast Randall's argument, saying she's just reinforcing stereotypes about African-American culture and relationships or just blaming the victim. But whatever you thought of Randall's argument, it's clear she's thought a lot about it. She takes on the issue of black women and weight in her new novel, Ada's Rules. Ada is a preacher's wife who wages her own war with weight as she cares for the flock, her husband, grown kids, and her aging parents. It's something that Alice Randall talked about for a video promoting her book.
I love Ada. She's my funniest character. She's a large black woman who has the audacity to be in love with her body and her life, and to be sexy at the same time. And she's practical enough to try and do something about her health. At the beginning of the novel, she is 220 pounds, and she thinks her gorgeous husband may be having an affair, though he seems to still be in love with her.
Author Alice Randall will join our regular Moms contributors to dish on their own battles with weight and on her book, Ada's Rules. That's next Tuesday on Tell Me More. And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and you've been listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.